Today is July 25th. Welcome to Don Sicker Meditation Center. You're from Vimalaranchi. And tonight you'll be doing from Majjhima Nikaya number 73, by Mahavachagosa Sutta, the very discourse of Vachagosa.
Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel's sanctuary. Why anybody would want to live in a squirrel sanctuary is beyond me. They're always climbing around on you and such. Then the wanderer Vachagata went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, "I have had conversations with Master Gotama for a long time. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach me in brief the wholesome and the unwholesome." "I can teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome in brief, Vacha, and I can teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome at length. Still, I will teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome in brief. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, Venerable Sir," he replied, "the Blessed One said this: Vacha, greed is unwholesome. Non-greed is wholesome. Hate is unwholesome. Non-hate is wholesome. Delusion is unwholesome. Non-delusion is unwholesome. In this way, three things are unwholesome, and the other three things are wholesome. Killing living beings is unwholesome. Abstention from killing living beings is wholesome. Taking what is not given is unwholesome. Abstention from taking what is not given is wholesome. Misconduct in sensual pleasures is unwholesome. Abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures is wholesome. False speech is unwholesome. Abstention from false speech is wholesome. Malicious speech is unwholesome. Abstention from malicious speech is wholesome. Harsh speech is unwholesome. Abstention from harsh speech is wholesome. Gossip is unwholesome. Abstention from gossip is wholesome. Covetousness is unwholesome. Uncovetousness is wholesome. Ill will is unwholesome. Non-ill will is wholesome. Wrong view is unwholesome. Right view is wholesome. Wrong view is taking things personally. Okay, anytime you have "this is me, this is my thought, this is my feeling," that is unwholesome. When you see it impersonally, then that is right view, or right view, and it is wholesome. In this way, 10 things are unwholesome and the other 10 things are wholesome. When a monk has abandoned craving, cut it off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so that it is no longer subject to future arising, then that monk is an arahat with taints destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. Apart from Master Gotama, is there any one monk in Master Gotama's discipline who is, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now, enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints? There are not only 100 vacha, or 200 or 300 or 400 or 500, but far more monks, my disciples, who have realized for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, entered upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. Apart from Master Gotama and the monks, is there any one bhikkhuni, Master Gotama's disciple, who, by realizing for herself with direct knowledge here and now, enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints? There are not only 100 or 500, but far more bhikkhunis, my disciples, who by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. Apart from Master Gotama and the bhikkhunis, and our bhikkhus, or monks and bhikkhunis, is there any one man lay follower, Master Gotama's disciple, clothed in white, leading a life of celibacy, who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever entering from that world? So what he's saying is, are there any laymen that have overcome lust and hatred, the five lower fetters, no more doubt, belief that rites and rituals will lead to nibbana, a belief in a, they have the understanding of everything is impersonal. They have no more lust, no more hatred. There are some people in Indonesia that are very much afraid of this state. They want their sensual pleasures. There's a lot of, because they're mostly Chinese, there's a lot of pressure when someone gets married to start having kids. And it just doesn't work very well. And I've been accused of being a breaker up of relations because somebody attains anagami. They're no longer interested in sexual activity at all. Doesn't arise in them. So I am a family breaker. There are not only 100 or even 500, but far more lay followers, men lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, will appear spontaneously in pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Apart from Master Gotama and the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and the men lay followers clothed in white. Now, the clothed in white, in Asia, whenever they would visit the monastery, they would dress in white. And that has since changed to on the new moon and full moon, or if they're there for doing meditation, they dress in white. I haven't insisted on that here, but actually it is a good idea. The men lay followers clothed in white leading to the lives of celibacy. Is there any one man lay follower, Master Gotama, Gotama's disciple, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carries out his instructions and responds to his advice, has gone beyond doubt, free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in teacher's dispensation? Now he's asking about it, any lay followers, male lay followers, that have become a Sakadagami. That means a once returner. That means that you're only going to be reborn in this world one more time before you get off of the wheel of samsara. There are not only 100 or even 500, far more men lay followers, my disciples clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carry out my instructions, respond to my advice, have gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. Being independent of others means you know what the path is. All you have to do is keep following that path, and that will lead to higher states. Apart from Master Gotama, the monks and bhikkhunis and the lay followers clothed in white, both those leading to lives of celibacy and those enjoying sensual pleasures. Is there any one woman lay follower, Master Gotama's disciple, clothed in white, leading a life of celibacy, who with the destruction of the five lower fetters will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world? Now, this is a really important sutta. When I went to Germany, there was one of their famous teachers that said it's impossible to attain nibbana and get to these states unless you're a monk. And everybody believed him. And they came and told me, I said, that's not true. You'll see for yourself if you just keep practicing the way that I'm teaching. There are not only 100, but even 500, far, far more women lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, who with the destruction of the five lower fetters will reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. So that pretty much answers the question of whether women can attain nibbana. Apart from Master Gotama, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, the men lay followers clothed in white, both those leading a life of celibacy and those enjoying sensual pleasures, and the women lay follower clothed in white, lives leading lives of celibacy. Is there any one woman lay follower, Master Gotama's disciple, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carries out his instructions, responds to his advice, and has gone beyond doubt, free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation? There are not only 100, but 500, and even more. Women lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, carry out my instructions, respond to my advice, have gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. Master Gotama, if only Master Gotama were accomplished in this Dhamma, but no monks were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But Master Gotama and his monks are accomplished in this Dhamma. This holy life is thus complete in that respect. If only Master Gotama's monks were accomplished in this Dhamma, but no bhikkhunis were accompanied, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama's monks and bhikkhunis are accomplished in this Dhamma, this holy life is thus complete in that respect. If only Master Gotama's monks and bhikkhunis were accomplished in this Dhamma, but no men lay followers clothed in white leading lives of celibacy were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama's monks and bhikkhunis were, and men lay followers clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy are accomplished in this Dhamma, this holy life is thus complete in that respect. If only Master Gotama's monks, bhikkhunis, and men lay followers clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy were accomplished in this Dhamma, but no men lay followers clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama's monks, bhikkhunis, lay followers clothed in white, both those leading lives of celibacy and enjoying sensual pleasures are accomplished in this Dhamma, this Dhamma is thus complete in that respect. If only Master Gotama, monks and bhikkhunis, and men lay followers clothed in white were accomplished in this Dhamma, but no women lay followers clothed in white, living lives of celibacy were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama, monks, bhikkhunis, men lay follower clothed in white, and women lay follower clothed in white, lives leading lives of celibacy are accomplished in this Dhamma, this holy life is thus complete in that respect. But if Master Gotama's monks and bhikkhunis, men lay followers clothed in white, and women lay followers clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy were accomplished in this Dhamma, but no men lay, or no women lay followers clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because Master Gotama, monks and bhikkhunis, men lay followers clothed in white, both those leading lives of celibacy and those enjoying sensual pleasures, and women lay followers clothed in white, both those leading lives of celibacy and enjoying sensual pleasures are accomplished in this Dhamma, this holy life is thus complete in that respect. Just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes towards the sea, flows towards the sea, and reaches the sea, so too Master Gotama's assembly, with the homeless ones and the householders inclined towards Nibbana, slopes towards Nibbana, flows towards Nibbana, and reaches Nibbana. Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways. As though he were turning upright what had been overcome, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha. I would receive the going forth, Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission. Vacha. One who formerly belonged to another sect and desires the going forth and the full admission in this Dhamma and discipline lives on probation for 4 months. At the end of 4 months, if the monks are satisfied with him, they give him the going forth and the full admission to the monk's state. But I recognize individual differences in this matter. Venerable Sir, if those who formerly belong to another sect and desire the going forth and full admission in this Dhamma and discipline live on probation for 4 months, and at the end of the 4 months the monks were satisfied and give them the full going forth and the full admission to the monk state, then I will live on probation for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, if the monks are satisfied with me, let me give him and let them give me the going forth and full admission to the monk state. Then the wanderer Vachagata received the going forth under the Blessed One and received the full admission. Not long after his full admission, a half a month after his full admission, the Venerable Vachagata went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, sat down at one side and told the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, I have attained whatever can be attained by knowledge of a disciple in higher training. By true knowledge of a disciple in higher training, let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma further. In that Kate Vacha, develop further two things, serenity and insight. When these two things, serenity and insight, are developed further, they will lead to the penetration of many elements. To the extent that you may wish, may I wield the various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, may I become many. Having been many, may I become one. That would be useful around here. Work on that one, would you? May I appear and vanish. May I go unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain, as though through space. May I dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. May I walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, may I travel in space like a bird. With my hand, may I touch and stroke the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty. I've asked many monks about what does this mean, and I've never gotten a satisfactory answer. So I can't tell you what it means to touch this, touch and stroke the moon and the sun. May I will bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. That means go visit the different Brahma worlds. You will attain the ability to witness any aspect therein, there being a suitable basis. To the extent that you may wish, may I, with a divine I element, which is purified and surpasses the human, hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near. And I have told you about students that I've had that develop both the divine eye and the divine ear. And I test them. And this one lady that was successful with the test, I told her that my mother lived in California. I told her the town. I didn't tell her anything else. And I said, what street does she live on? What's the address of the house? And what color clothing is she wearing at the time? And she told me. I called up my mother afterwards and asked her what color clothing she was wearing. It happened to be blue at the time. And she said, blue, and I said, thanks, and hung up. And I did later explain to her why I called her to find that out. You will attain the ability to witness any aspects therein, there being a suitable basis. To the extent that you may wish, may I understand the minds of others, of other persons, having encompassed them with my own mind. May I understand a mind affected by lust as mine affected by lust, and mine unaffected by lust as mine unaffected by lust. May I understand a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. and a mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. May I understand a mind affected by delusion as affected by delusion, and a mind unaffected by delusion as unaffected by delusion. May I understand a contracted mind. What's a contracted mind? I can't hear you. You're right. Good, you finally got it. Because your mind does contract when it does that. And I understand a contracted mind as contracted and a distracted mind as distracted. What's a distracted mind? That's all I hear about when you come down for the interviews is a distracted mind. Tell me what it is. Restlessness, they're right. May I understand an exalted mind as exalted, an unexalted mind as unexalted. What is an exalted mind?
Rupa Jhana.
That's right. May I understand a surpassed mind as surpassed, an unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed. What is surpassed mind? Arupa Jhanas. Why is it surpassed? Because you're only in a mental realm. Huh?
Without forms.
Without material. I understand a collected mind as collected and an uncollected mind as uncollected. May I understand a liberated mind as liberated and an unliberated mind as unliberated. You will attain the ability to witness any aspects therein, there being a suitable basis. That means reading other people's minds. People that are very sensitive to feeling, this is quite easy to have occur. When people are sensitive to feeling, they get quite emotional. They can act in really strange ways because they're picking up other people's thoughts. And they don't recognize them as other people's thoughts, and that causes all kinds of problems. But when you start doing this kind of practice, you'll be able to tell the difference between thoughts that you have and thoughts that other people have. And you have to be careful with this kind of ability. There was one lady that she was quite good at it, and she started telling people about the difficulties they were having, and it was like really personal thoughts, and she was upsetting a lot of people, and I had to tell her to stop doing it. Just because you have this ability, you don't show it off. It'll save you a lot of pain and suffering if you keep it to yourself. To the extent that one may wish, may I recollect my manifold past lifetimes, that is one birth to all the way up to the world cycles, the expansion and contraction of the universe. I did meet one bhikkhuni in Burma, that she could remember an asankhya, which is 10 with 160 zeros behind it in years. And she remembered many, many, I want to say millions of lifetimes. And because she had that ability, other people would come to her and they would say, about my past lifetimes, tell me. And she would tell, and she actually started developing the ability to see into the future. Because there is no such a thing as time, it's only a concept. And she became quite famous in Burma for having that ability, and a lot of people were coming to her and trying to find out, am I going to be rich? And these kind of things. But it was troublesome to her. That's why you don't tell other people about these kind of abilities, because they want to see it. And it's just, it's good for distracting people away from the spiritual life as the Buddha teaches it. So it gets to be rather troublesome. And there was one monk that I studied with for about 6 months. And he had that ability, and he had some other abilities too, and he always was kind of showing them off. And they got him into some big problems, because people of other religions didn't like him doing that sort of thing. And they started accusing him of having sexual activities and all kinds of things. And his pride was such that right before I left him to go study with somebody else, he told me in confidence that he was in Australia at the time. He was a Thai monk. He couldn't go anywhere in Thailand without having huge numbers of people around him. And he hid out on one of the islands. And the Thai missed him so much that they hired a detective to find him. And when they found him, then they advertised it, and there was like thousands of people were going to him. If he was going to be giving a talk, there might be 50,000 people that showed up. That's how popular he was. But he told me, and he had kind of a Jesus complex, and he said that he went to Australia because not so many people would follow. And he was going to just taking rest, and then he was going to become world famous. And as soon as he told me that, I thought in my mind, boy, be careful of what you're wishing for. He did become world famous. He was in the Time magazine causing a schism, because somebody accused him of having sexual activity. Now he was kind of strange, because he didn't sleep very much. And he would stay up till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and then he would get up around 8 o'clock. But when I was with him, he was going out at night and traveling around and seeing what nightlife was. And he would stop and talk to women of ill repute, and they would ask him for money, and he would give it to them. And somebody saw him do that, and they accused him of having sexual activity, and he didn't. But there was proof. He gave someone a credit card and say, here, take $25 or $50 from the on a credit card. And they had that proof. And they put such pressure on him and told him that he had to disrobe. And he refused because he says, I've done nothing wrong. And it hurt all of the other monks in Thailand because people started losing faith in the monks themselves. And they had trouble getting food, and the king had to step in. And he asked this monk to disrobe, and he did it for the king. But then he took on green robes, which is not a color that monks wear. And about a year after that, then he was reinstated as a full monk. And they found out that there was a lot of lies and that sort of thing that were being told about him. And he didn't want to stay in Thailand anymore, because everywhere he went there were people that were arguing about whether he should really be a monk or not. So he came to America. And then he was in Los Angeles for quite a while. And he got written up in newspapers and that sort of thing, LA Times, and people would come visit him. And then he just went on a walkabout. And I haven't heard from him since. He was about 10 years younger than I was at the time. And he practiced Dutanga practices. He would go out and just walk in the forest and all of those kind of Dutanga things, only use three robes. And he always carried his bowl wherever he went, things like that. But he was written up as causing a real problem in Thailand, with different people defending him, other people accusing him. So it got to be real difficult. And he wasn't. He actually made the cover page on Newsweek. They took a photograph of him walking around doing something. I don't remember exactly what it was. And then I thought, oh, he wanted to be world famous, and now he is. So you got to be careful with those kind of things, what you really want to see happen. Thus, with these aspects and particulars, may I recollect manifold past lives. You will attain the ability to witness any aspect therein, there being a suitable basis. To the extent that he may wish, may I, with a divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And you've heard me give the discourse on karma, and we went through all of that. And may I understand how beings pass on according to their actions. You will attain the ability to witness any aspect therein, there being a suitable basis. To the extent that you may wish, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mine and deliverance by wisdom. that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. Now, you can point your mind in that direction to have this occur. There is something in Pali that my teacher, Usilananda, he called it wholesome desire. And with this wholesome desire, what you do is you point your mind in the direction you want it to go. You want to get off the wheel of samsara. And then let it go and don't think about it again. Which is real easy to do and talk, say and talk about. But what happens with people after they attain Nibbana the first time is their mind will start to settle down and become very peaceful, and you feel your mind getting more and more deep. And right before the Nibbana occurs, you wind up jumping at it. And that stops it from happening because that desire comes up. It is a desireless state. So what we're talking about here is kind of important for you to actually hear and start practicing what I tell you. Before you sit, you make the determination to only observe what happens next. Keep backing away, keep watching. And any disturbance that you have in your mind, you relax and continue watching. Your mind will settle down so that you'll be able to sit for half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, without any disturbance in your mind at all. And one of my students used to drive me crazy because she could sit in that state. And she'd sit for an hour, and then she would break her sitting, get up and start running around. And she did that for 3 years. Made me want to tear my hair out. She just kept on getting up. Well, there's nothing happening. My mind's not moving at all, so I might as well get up and run around, do this and that. Well, no. You need the time to keep your mind pure without any disturbances in it. That means you're getting closer to the experience of the unconditioned Nibbana. After 3 years, she finally heard me, and she was very successful after that. And every year I bring that up as an example of what not to do in Indonesia. It always makes her laugh when I do that. Then the Venerable Vajragatha, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, departed. Before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Vajragatha, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done, and there is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Vajragatha became one of the Arahats. Now on that occasion, a number of monks were going to see the Blessed One. The Venerable Vajragatha saw them coming in the distance. seeing them, he went to them and asked them, "Where are the venerable ones going?" "We're going to see the Blessed One, friend." "In that case, may the venerable ones pay homage in my name with their heads at the Blessed One's feet, saying, 'Venerable Sir, the monk Vajragata pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet.' Then say, 'The Blessed One has been worshipped by me. The Sublime One has been worshipped by me.'" I don't like the word worshipped, but we'll let that go. "Yes, friend," those monks replied. Then they went to the Blessed One, after paying homage to him, sat down at one side and told the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, the Venerable Vajragata pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet and says, 'The Blessed One has been worshipped by me. The Sublime One has been worshipped by me.'" Monks, having encompassed his mind with his own mind, "I already knew the Venerable, the Bhikkhu Vajragata, the monk Vajragata, has attained the threefold true knowledge and has great supernormal power and might. And deities also told me that the monk Vajragata has attained the threefold true knowledge and has great supernormal power and might." The three powers are, supernormal powers are remembering past lifetimes, where you lose all doubt that karma is real, because you see it in your own life. He would visit, the second true knowledge is visiting, different hell realms and heavenly realms and talking with people there. And the last one is seeing and understanding dependent origination. Those are the three supernormal powers. These psychic abilities, one of the rules for the monks is that we don't show off psychic abilities. But they generally do. If they have some psychic ability, they want to show it off and become very popular. And then they find out being popular is not all it's cracked up to be. It's not a good thing to do. So the Buddha made it one of the rules, it's one of the Pachetiya rules, that you don't let other people know about these abilities. There was a monk in the 30s and 40s in Thailand that became very, very famous because he had some of the psychic abilities. And they called him an arahat, but I don't believe he was, because he got into being taught in dreams by other arahats, and I really strongly suspect that not being the case. But people nowadays, they're so hungry to have an arahat. Anybody that displays a little bit of psychic ability becomes an arahat. And that happened to this monk that I was talking about before. In Thailand, whenever he was going to give a talk or be in some place for a period of time, there was lots and lots and lots of people that would come, and they would carry signs about, "Come see the arahat." He knew that he wasn't. he knew that he had never attained Nibbana. And he admitted that, I'm not an arahat, I just have psychic abilities, which is, it's good, it's fun. And he would walk, we'd go walking in the forest, there'd be three or four monks, and he would look up at a tree and he would point at it like that, and one tree would just start swaying like it was in a heavy wind. And that's showing off. And that's like, oh wow, you can really do that. You have that kind of power. And in my mind I was going, ho-hum, so what? Is that going to get you to experience Nibbana any quicker? No, it's going to slow it down because you think you're hot stuff. That's why I don't spend time teaching people, even with natural ability, to have psychic abilities. I get them to practice the six R's. Because it's very hard to teach these people once they get confidence in being able to do it whenever they wanted to. And the pride factor is real strong. And they are very hard to admonish because I don't have any psychic abilities, but I recognize that in you and I see the attachment to it. So when I was around people that were very sensitive to that sort of thing and started developing those abilities naturally, I was always admonishing them, stop doing that. You need to use the six R's. You need to develop your ability to see how dependent origination works. This is the key to the practice. And sometimes they left, never saw them again, but I heard about them. And they wind up getting in some kind of trouble in one way or another because of those kind of abilities and showing them off. And people start making up stories about you if you show off your abilities. One of the very famous Sayadaws that I hung out with him for a bit, not a whole long time. He was said to, he developed his practice so that he never lied down. From the time he became a monk until he died, he never laid down on his back. And he was flying in an airplane, and somebody that was traveling with him had a dream that the airplane, one of the engines went out, and they saw in his dream, they saw Sayadaw, Tongpulu Sayadaw, sitting on the wing holding it up so that they could fly all the way to where they were going. And it was just somebody's dream, and all of a sudden I'm hearing stories about, his flying ability is so good, and all of these kind of things. No. But occasionally somebody would ask him, Bhante, is there life on other planets? And he would say, yes, I've seen it. So? So you have that ability, so what? He didn't understand much about dependent origination, but he was a very advanced meditator. He could get into neither perception nor non-perception with one-pointed concentration. And that's a very high state to be in, but it doesn't get you off the wheel of samsara. And since I've been teaching with the six R's, I have a lot of students that can get to that stage.
One of the good attributes of the Dhamma is that it's immediately effective. And because you learn what craving is and how to let it go, your progress in the meditation is very fast. It has to be. The Buddha wasn't going to teach somebody that it was a farmer that had a lot of work to do. He wasn't going to teach them a meditation that was going to take 40 years to develop. He had to teach them something that developed fairly quickly. So many people, and I did spend many years going around Asia asking, what is craving? Because I always got unsatisfactory answers. What is craving? They generally slide by saying, well, it's desire. But how are you supposed to recognize it when it arises? Well, you can always see your desires when they arise. How do you let it go? Quit desiring. Well, that's all surface answers. It doesn't work that way. Just like the definition of mindfulness. How many people do you talk to about what is mindfulness and how many different answers do you get? If you're with psychotherapists, oh, that's being aware. Well, that's kind of right and kind of not. Mindfulness is remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. That's so much different than having a mind full. It's having a mind that's observant. And to this day, even some of my students that are starting to teach more and more, they're still giving the definition of remembering to be aware of mind. And that's not a good definition. It's remembering to observe how mind's attention moves, not why it moves. We don't care about why. That's just more analytical thinking. That's wishing and hoping. But when you look at how mind's attention moves, that means you have to look at more closely to see this process that we call life. How does it work? And when your mindfulness is sharp and you use the six R's in the correct way, your progress in the meditation will be very good. One of the problems that has occurred over the years is people that are practicing meditation will tell you just to watch it until it goes away. And that's not right effort. You don't watch anything. If you're trying to watch something go away, then you are there and you're trying to control it. And if you're there, that means craving is there, because craving is the start of that false belief in a personal self. Every time you take a thought personally, there is delusion in your mind. What is delusion? This is me. This is who I am. That's deluded thinking. You're not seeing things the way they actually are. And then you go back to the definition of mindfulness, remembering to observe how mind's attention moves. So watching something until it goes away and then immediately come back to your object of meditation, whatever that happens to be, is a stumbling block. One, you're not recognizing the cause of suffering, which is craving. And you keep bringing that craving back to your object of meditation. You're going to hit walls. You're going to hit places where you feel like I've gone as far as I can. That's it. It doesn't work very well. But with that kind of meditation, there are some brief moments of relief from your regular way of looking at the world, and a lot of people have a lot of pride because of that. But they're not really going to the depth that they need to go to. One of the things that's real popular because of the straight Vipassana practice is just seeing impermanence, suffering, and not-self, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Nobody knows what not-self means, so they don't really talk about it very much. Not-self means seeing the impersonal nature. But everybody puts too much emphasis on impermanence, and they see it in a superficial way. That's why that statement in the Mahavagga, you can see one or all of the three characteristics of existence without ever seeing the links of dependent origination. And that's what the Vipassana people are doing. And they're saying, well, then if you see anicca arise three or four times very quickly in a row, or a dukkha or anatta, and then you have a space where there's a blank spot, then you've attained nibbana. But that's not in agreement with what it says in the suttas. In this statement in the Mahavagga, you can see one or all of the characteristics without ever seeing or even recognizing anything about dependent origination. But when you see the links of dependent origination, you're seeing up close and personal how everything changes. Because if that's 100,000 arising and passing away of hearing consciousness, and you get to a place where you can see individual consciousnesses come and go away very quickly, then when you get to the deeper stages of the meditation and you have this mind that's super clear and silent and exquisitely peaceful, and you start to see something come up, you're seeing 1/12 of one consciousness, and you see it arise and pass away. So what this statement in the Mahavagga says is, when you see the links of dependent origination, you always see impermanent suffering and not self. You're seeing everything as a process. Everything is part of a process. So it gets to be a real interesting depth of practice that turns out to be quite fun, because you start seeing this and recognizing it, and then you start getting insights into that. Oh, that's what that was. Wow. From the very beginning of your practice, I've told you three things. I want you to smile. I want you to laugh with yourself because your mind is crazy. And I want you to have fun. Okay? That carries through all the way to Arahatship. You smile because it makes your mind lighter, makes your observation of how things occur much easier. You laugh with yourself because your mind is absolutely bonkers. Everybody's mind is, that's a human being, unless they get to be an arahat. They're the only people that are considered completely sane. Mind is crazy. It's going to come up with all kinds of nonsense. Old habitual tendencies. Well, when this situation happens, it's like the one that happened a long time ago. I'm going to act in the same way. And how much suffering do you cause yourself when you do that? How much pain do you cause yourself? Because you can't blame the outside world for your pain. Your pain arises because you are attached to something. You're trying to control something in the way you want it to be. You're trying to make things be the way you want it to be, when you want it to be that way. And the more you do that, the more you suffer. And you can't blame me for your suffering, although I get blamed a lot for everything else. It's always my fault. Doesn't matter what it is. When I was up on the hill teaching these college students, they'd come and they'd tell me some insight. And I said, are you blaming me for that? I get blamed for everything. The good as well as the bad. Just nonsense stuff. The more you settle mind down, the more you take an interest in how hindrances arise. And I'm not talking gross things, but, oh, I have this hatred of this or that, and I'm restless about this or that. I'm talking about what happens first. Now, your mind was on your object of meditation, and then it wasn't. How did that happen? It doesn't just all of a sudden, well, there's sadness, or there's anxiety, or my mind always takes off and worries about this or that. Well, why does that happen? Because your mindfulness is not sharp enough to see how this process works. Every time you have any kind of repeat thought, you have an attachment. Somebody says something that you don't like. you walk away and then you start thinking about all the reasons you don't like that. And then just like it's on a tape deck, it happens again. Well, who has an attachment? Who's taking it personally? Who's causing themselves pain? You can't blame that other person because you're doing it to yourself. Every time we take anything personally, craving is there. It's a painful feeling, I don't like it. It's a pleasant feeling, I really like it. I want it more. I. But there's nothing in the physical universe that's the way we see with these eyes. The interesting thing about, I tell you to sit still, don't move. Can you? No? Why? Well, your blood's moving, your heart's beating, you're breathing. There's lots of movements that are happening. And then you get down smaller. The molecules, the atoms, the electrons, the neutrons, they're always moving. The earth is moving. You can't sit still. Sit without moving. Impossible. In the ultimate sense of things. And it's all impersonal. This stuff happens because conditions are right for it to happen. So what are you going to do with what arises in the present moment? You're going to fight with it? You're going to try to control it? You're going to try to just make yourself suffer more? You can do that. But it sure gets tiresome. It's really not very nice how we make ourselves suffer. We really cause ourselves so much pain. The Buddha talked about if you saw how many tears you've shed in all of your lifetimes, it would fill up an ocean. Now that's a lot of tears. And why does that keep happening over and over again? Because of attachment. What is the attachment? I am that. I am my thoughts. I am my feelings. Every time you take anything personally, that is the cause of suffering. A wholesome desire in Pali is chanda. I started talking to one student about chanda and they thought, oh, if you have wholesome desire, that means you can have wholesome hatred. No, you can't have wholesome hatred. A wholesome desire is something that doesn't have any attachment to it. If I want to go to from here to New York, all I have to do is say, okay, I'm going to New York and I'll head that way if I really want to go there. I don't have to think about it every time I get in the car, where am I going now? I already made up my mind, I'm going to New York or California, whatever, it doesn't really matter. Wholesome desire means pointing your mind in the direction you want it to go and then forgetting about it. You don't have to tell yourself over and over and over again, I'm going to New York. I have to go to New York. You already made up your mind, then go. The thinking about it over and over again, Who's thinking? Who's causing themselves suffering by doing that? So the whole idea with wholesome desire is an important aspect. And one of the near enemies of wholesome desire is longing. I've been on the road so long. How much longer do I have to wait to get there? Who's trying to direct what's happening? I am. Who's never going to get there with those kind of thoughts? Me. That's why I said, when you sit, make the determination just to observe. That's all. What happens first when your mind starts moving? What happens after that? What happens after that? When you're in your lower stages of meditation, you don't see your mind start to move and wobble, and then it wobbles, and now it's 1,000 miles away thinking about this or that. But there's something that happens before that little tiny wobble starts up, comes up and goes away. Tell me what that is. I won't tell you. You have to tell me. I want to make sure you see it. But there's something that happens even before that. So, I'm a tricky monk. A lot of times I won't tell you some things that are very obvious. I wait for you to figure it out yourself and then tell me about it. I'll know where you are, what you're doing. One of the truly amazing things about the suttas, and we were talking about it today at lunch, or in the morning, whenever it was, you first pick up the suttas and you start to read it and you go, yeah, okay. I don't understand any of that. You're not going to understand it right away unless you start doing the meditation. When you start having some direct experience, then you'll run across something and go, oh, that's what that meant. You start getting insights. And the magic of the Buddha's teaching is you can hear something for 50 times and get something different out of it each time. It's really kind of magical the way it happens like that. But you have to be practicing along with. When I first got back to America, I was carrying around my middle neck sayings. And this lady said, what book is that? So I showed it to her. She ordered it. And she said, well, how am I supposed to understand what this is saying? I said, well, first off, you don't read sutta number one like you're reading a book. You bounce around. You just open up a page. What sutta is that? Go to the start of that sutta and read it. It will talk to you. And she started doing it and she started going, you know, this is the most extraordinary experience I've ever had. It's like the book came alive and it wanted to tell me something. Well, that's the Buddha's teaching. He's very, very good, and there's so many different levels of understanding. And the more deeply you can go into the meditation and follow the instructions the way they're given, because they're not my instructions, they are the Buddha's instructions. Your progress in the meditation becomes phenomenal. When I first started out, the first time I heard about jhanas, I became immediately enthralled with them, because they're in the suttas quite often. So there must be something important in that. But I was told that it takes years and years of hard practice to get into the jhana. What I wasn't told until I started figuring out on my own that there's more than one kind of jhana. There's the absorption jhana, one-pointed concentration jhana, where you bring that craving back to your object of meditation. That's very limited. And your mind goes, zzz, and it just stays on one point, like a laser. Well, that's a big so what. Ah, but you get all this bliss, and it's such a wonderful relief from having no hindrances arise. But there's no personality development with that. I've seen people get into close spiritual people that started arguing about this practice or that practice, you're wrong and I'm right. They almost came to blows. And they were, quote, very advanced meditators. And they're getting in fights about philosophy? What is that? There's something wrong with that practice. And I have a lot of friends that have been meditating for years and years. And they got so far, and they just feel like there's something, some kind of block in their way. And they hit a wall. What are you supposed to do with that? The meditators, the teachers that don't understand what they're really doing and teaching, they say, well, you just kind of have to grin and bear it. It'll change after a while. That block will go away. And after 5 or 6 years of doing the same thing over and over again, a lot of people stop meditating because it just doesn't make sense. It's a waste of time because there's no real understanding. There's no real practice that helps you grow more and more. Unless you run across somebody that can help you to recognize craving when it arises and gives you a good definition of craving. Anything else? Okay, why don't we share some merit then? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu.